Welcome to the Family Farm Podcast, priority topics for family medicine and community pharmacy. Hi everyone, my name's Tina, and I'm a pharmacist in Vancouver.
Nice. And I'm Billy Lin. I'm still a family practice resident at UBC.
Nice.
So today we have a new idea for podcasts. For the next, I think, 8 episodes, I will attempt to teach Tina what I learned at the St. Paul's CME conference that I just attended last week. And the conference was 4 days long, broken into 8 half days, and each half day has a theme. And I think we can talk about the pearls that I took home from each of the half days in 8 different episodes.
That sounds good. And I see your binder here is very, very thick.
Well, don't worry too much, because I'm only covering the very fine pearls that I learned, not the whole thing.
Just the pearls.
Just the pearls. No BS.
Sounds good.
All right. So the first half day was actually a mixed match of internal medicine topics. The first one was on alcohol use. And the take-home message I learned from it was 75% of patients with alcohol use issues actually are still highly functioning. They go to work and they're dressed appropriately, and they might not strike you as having a big alcohol use problem. And in fact, if you see them in the office, you might not even think to ask them about their alcohol use. So the take-home point I learned from that is we should really routinely screen for alcohol use. And what I think I will start doing is, as part of the social history that I ask patients, I'll ask them not only how much alcohol they use, and also if they have any problems with alcohol use in the past, for themselves or for their families. I think that would give a little bit more sensitivity to the questions to ask about alcohol use. And once I find a problem that I'm concerned with, I will start skipping around the issue and use statements like, as your physician, I am concerned about your alcohol use. Would you like to talk about that a little bit more? Or something to that effect, something more direct, and let the patient know that the issue should be taken seriously.
And you would say that to any patients that like shines a red flag for that, even though their main concern was an alcohol abuse?
I think so. Maybe if it's not the topic of that visit, I might say we can talk about that in the future visit. If I think they may have an issue with alcohol use, I will try not to let that slip by. To screen for alcohol use, I'll probably still use the try and true CAGE questionnaire, which is an acronym for cutting down, where if the patient has thought about cutting down on their alcohol use or annoyance, the patient getting annoyed about someone talking to them about their alcohol use, or feeling of guilt, feeling guilty or feeling bad about their alcohol use, and eye-opener if they have to use alcohol to start their day, because without alcohol they're feeling pretty lousy. And 2 out of 4 for men, or 1 out of 4 of these questions being positive for women, is considered high risk for having alcohol use issues. Now, there are 3 medications that I've seen used for chronic alcohol use. They are naltrexone, acamprosate, and disulfiram. And Tina, what can you tell me about those 3 medications?
Yeah, so let's go first to naltrexone. So naltrexone, just briefly on the mechanism, it's a competitive antagonist at the opioid receptor.
Mm-hmm.
It is commonly used for alcohol abuse, but it also is dangerous if people also have opioid dependence. It can cause some opioid withdrawal as well.
Mm-hmm.
So for patients that have used opioid within the past 7 to 10 days, don't give them naltrexone for their alcohol abuse conditions. So for those patients that's not using opioids, you can give them naltrexone. Its duration is about 24 hours for 50 milligrams, about 48 hours for about 100 milligrams of naltrexone. And yeah,
my understanding is it will reduce craving. Is that?
Yeah, usually it will reduce craving because it's a competitive antagonist. So it will reduce the craving for alcohol.
Okay, what about disulfiram?
So disulfiram is an interesting drug. There was a brand name product before, but now it's discontinued. Now rarely do we dispense in community pharmacy. From what I've seen up until now, I never really seen it dispensed in community practice. But then if you look into the PharmaCare formulary, it's actually listed as a compounded medication. So you can use the powder to compound like capsules for patients if they actually have to go down that route.
And what does it do for patients?
So its main thing, it works very differently than naltrexone, where naltrexone decreases their cravings. Disulfiram, it can actually increase that uncomfortable effect if patients take alcohol with disulfiram together. So what it means is if the patients drink some alcohol while they're on this medication, they can have increased flushing, nausea, thirst, palpitations, chest pain, hypotension, all these bad stuff. So then they wouldn't want to drink alcohol again because it's associated with all these uncomfortable feelings.
I thought it would be dangerous if they drink a larger amount of alcohol on this medication. So we should only use it for patients who are determined to quit and they just need a little bit of extra incentive to stay off of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
If someone is still actively drinking, then this is not the medication of choice.
No, it can be very dangerous if they're continuing to drink that much amount of alcohol while on this drug. And so some other things about this medication, it can cause about 1 to 2 weeks of effects even after drinking the alcohol. So if the patient stops using the medication within 1 to 2 weeks later, they should not be drinking alcohol or they will be experiencing the same effect. Other adverse drug reactions, dizziness, headache, and also has a weird garlic-like aftertaste with it.
I like garlic.
No, and then you don't want to go on this drug just because of the garlic.
Okay. And acamprosate, I think, yeah, it's less commonly used. My understanding is that it also decreases craving. I think the psychiatrist I work with considered this medication, but she was concerned that the liver enzyme will be elevated by this medication, so she wanted to make sure the patient's liver enzyme was stabilized before she starts the medication. But okay, so the next talk was on gout. There was one thing about gout that was really striking for me. And it's regarding the genetic testing for HLA-B star 5801, which is a special gene or a genetic allele that if the patient has this allele, they're 80 to 100 times more likely to get Stevens-Johnson syndrome on allopurinol.
Oh, no, that's...
And this gene is common in Asians, especially Chinese, Koreans, and Thai.
That's interesting.
I actually...
How do you get tested?
It was a genetic test, so you send your sample, probably a blood sample, for PCR. I don't know if it's a blood sample or like a cheek swab, but yeah.
We'll find that out.
Yeah, you're testing your DNA, basically.
Yeah, but then it's very interesting because so many allopurinol is prescribed, and how many people are actually getting tested by this?
I don't know. I feel kind of scared.
Actually, a lot of Asians are on allopurinol.
Yes, yeah, because gout is fairly common in the Asian population as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one big learning point for me. And actually, a statement from the American College of Rheumatology stated that prior to initiation of allopurinol, PCR should be done to test for the HLA-B5801 allele for patients at higher risk for severe allopurinol reaction. including all Chinese and Thai patients, as well as Korean patients with stage 3 or worse chronic kidney disease. Another one is the antihypertensive agents for gout. And it's recommended to use losartan or calcium channel blockers. They actually have an effect on reducing the risk of gout. Compared to the other ones, the diuretics, the beta blockers, the ACE inhibitors, and the ARBs, which are not losartan, they actually increase the risk of gout, which I did not know.
So patients with hypertension and gout, and then they would go with losartan is probably the best choice.
Or calcium channel blockers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And for acute gout care, we know the first line agents are NSAIDs, colchicine, and glucocorticoids. And the speaker mentioned there is quote unquote medications in the pocket strategy, so that the patient has always access to a prescription for colchicine, for example, and they will go fill it and start taking it within 24 hours of onset of a gouty flare. And a recommended dosing is 2 doses of colchicine for a total of 1.2 milligrams for one dose, and then another 0.6 milligrams an hour later for a gouty flare. Speaking of colchicine, I know it's not an NSAID, but I didn't have quite a good idea of what it actually is. What can you tell us about it, Tina?
Yeah, so colchicine, the exact mechanism is not well understood yet, but what it does mainly also to decrease pain, anti-inflammatory, but it works differently to NSAIDs because it can arrest the cell divisions of neutrophils, and it can cause that chemotactic or making the neutrophils to be static in some way, and so that the neutrophils, it won't be activated in the body and cause all these inflammatory response. And that's what it does.
Okay.
Some people have been trying to use that for like a prophylactic, but it's generally not recommended for prophylactic measures.
Mm-hmm. So still the prophylactic agents would be allopurinol and other urate-lowering therapy.
Yeah.
Like probenecid. And the indication to start the prophylactic therapy is tophaceous gout on imaging or clinically, or greater than or equal to 2 gouty attacks per year, or gout with CKD greater than or equal to stage 2, or urolithiasis. Another learning point about gout is that gout is closely associated with metabolic syndrome. So if you have a patient with gout, you should probably look into whether or not they also have things like diabetes, dyslipidemia, and such. And to recommend about a diet for a patient with gout, they should still avoid high purine foods like red meat, alcohol, but they should also watch for their sugar intake. Because if you just recommend a low purine diet, the default for patients is that they will switch over to a high carbohydrate diet, which is bad for their cardiovascular disease. The next talk was kind of interesting. It's by an ID doctor talking to us about cellulitis and how to treat. Basically, she broke patients with cellulitis down into 2 groups. One is non-purulent cellulitis, or the cellulitis without wounds, abscess, or pus draining out, versus the group with abscesses, wound infections, and the cellulitis. So for the first group, where it's non-purulent, it's more likely to be caused by group A strep. And the recommended therapy is Keflex, or cephalexin, at dose of 500 milligrams 4 times a day by mouth. For the second group, with abscess or wound infection, aka the purulent cellulitis, the causative agent is more likely to be Staph aureus, but group A strep is still possible. So the recommended antibiotic is doxycycline, 100 milligrams PO twice a day, or Ceftra, or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Oh, I can say the word.
Sulfamethoxazole trimethoprim. Yeah, cool.
Cool. One double strength tablet PO BID. And you should also add Keflex to cover for the possible group A strep. Duration of therapy is 5 to 10 days, but should increase to 7 to 14 days or longer for complicated infections. If the patient has other risk factors like diabetes, a bite injury, then we should probably consult infectious disease specialist. Pretty cool, hey?
Yeah.
All right. Moving along.
Have you ever seen cellulitis in the community?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you give that? But how about you were saying consult ID specialist.
Yeah, yeah. So I had a patient with an old wound. He was attacked in the arm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's had a defensive wound. Someone attacked him with a steel pipe, and then he used his arm to block it. Had a deep laceration.
Oh, no.
It was cleaned and sutured in the merge, but he came to our clinic a week later with lots of erythema, swelling, pain, drainage, heat. Okay. So it was clearly a cellulitis with a wound infection. So which category would that fall in?
The second category.
Yes, yeah, the second category, which is the purulent cellulitis. So more likely to be a Staph aureus infection. But in the clinic, we didn't have enough equipment to do the IND. And we didn't feel totally comfortable with in terms of pain control. So we sent him to the eMERGE, where he was referred on to infectious disease.
Was this the guy that you were suggesting to open up?
Yep. Yeah. I told my attending doctor that we should probably open it and have a washout.
That's a good suggestion. And then they end up opening up the wound.
Yeah, the ID doctor later on opened
and debrided. 3 millimeter deep.
No, 3 centimeter deep. Yeah.
Oh, 3 centimeter deep.
Yeah, it was pretty deep.
Anyway.
But the guy is okay. The guy is okay.
Okay, well, I'm glad he's okay.
Okay, so a quick note, a quick take-home message on hepatitis C. For patients with hepatitis C RNA-positive serology, i.e. They have active hepatitis C virus, they should all be referred to GI specialist or hepatologist for consideration of hepatitis C treatment. Because we have curative treatment now.
Yes, we do. The medications are extremely expensive.
Extremely, extremely expensive.
I just recently dispensed one. Really? One box, $1,000+.
But the newer interferon-free medications are a lot more tolerable for the patient and very effective in eradicating HCV. So that's why we need to refer to the GI specialist for consideration of using these new medications. The next talk is on This Changed My Practice, which is an initiative from UBC, basically summarizing clinical evidence and what they did before and after learning about this new evidence. For example, a piece of evidence came out telling us that 5 days of prednisone use is equivalent to 14 days of prednisone use in patients with a COPD exacerbation. The author changed his practice to just using the prednisone for 5 days.
Oh, and it works.
And it works. Yeah, well, it works as well as 14 days. The study was done with prednisone 40 milligrams, and the member in the audience asked why people use 40 milligrams, which is 8 tablets of 5 milligrams.
We always had that question towards you guys.
Yeah, so that's why the study was done with 40 milligrams, but the speaker said it's much more convenient to use 15 milligram tablets, so sometimes he does that too. Okay, and this resource is basically on the website, thischangedmypractice.com. And I would recommend everyone to check that out. Okay, and then we had another talk on OSA, or obstructive sleep apnea. And the take-home message I got from it was that obstructive sleep apnea is closely associated with cardiovascular disease, stroke, diabetes, and hypertension, and basically, again, the metabolic syndrome. So for patients with OSA, I'll screen for those. And for patients with the metabolic syndrome, I'll screen for OSA.
How do you help them?
We'll send them for a sleep test, a sleep study. And if it's positive, then they might need a CPAP.
Mm.
It's a machine that helps them breathe at night. Yeah. This new CPAP is actually very quiet now. It's very less bulky.
Oh.
And it covers the nose. And it's easier to tolerate. So if you have patients who did not tolerate CPAP before, because of the mass, because of the noise, they should go back and check out the new machine and see if they can tolerate that a little bit better.
Okay. So that just recently came out?
I think it came out a couple of years.
Where can they buy it?
They'll rent it or buy it. But the community sleep labs, they also rent these machines. So for their business, sometimes they do the sleep study for free, because their goal is to convert the patients to become CPAP users, which will rent the machines or buy it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's enough for today. That was what I learned in the morning, the first morning of the conference, and I have 7 more like these coming up.
Well, I'm interested to see what you have to say later on.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
So next topic is the therapeutics, another hodgepodge, mixed match of basically unrelated topics. So stay tuned.
They're all related to medicine, though.
Yes. Yes, that's kind of the unifying theme for the first day of the conference.
Yes.
So until then, thank you for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Family Farm Podcast. Please leave your feedback and check out our show notes at fppodcast.org.